How are you doing?
I'm good. Good afternoon, good evening.
Good evening. How is everything going?
Terrific.
Nice. How's your day going?
It's good, you know, part of the downside or the upside of this pandemic is that we're spending a lot of time with family. And the lockdown has been, you know, interesting in a way that if you are a workaholic like me, the sort of the day bleeds into the evening and the evening, you know, into the weekdays, into the weekend. So sort of blurry where the day starts and ends.
Have you been able to find a rhythm and flow and a balance to kind of how you manage the workload of everything that's happening within the pandemic in your own personal life?
You know, I'm trying. So it started out that when at the beginning, I was sort of felt like I was on vacation, you know, like you're so excited, you don't have to like jump in the morning for an alarm clock and sort of. But then it pretty soon got out of control for the entire family. You know, I'm a mother of four kids. So trying to order to four children and maintain work and a household soon became challenging. So my friends who've been telecommuting for work prior to the pandemic. So I started kind of doing research and reaching out to colleagues. And one of the most profound advice I got was sort of setting a routine. So like every day I get up and put my clothes on and, you know, set my alarm and pretend like I'm going to work and really put boundaries around, you know, meal time and homework time and family time, because otherwise, I mean, even with this boundary, it's really hard to have demarcations.
Yeah, it's been interesting for me as well. I've been able to start a podcast about this process with a new brand called Ground Zero. And one thing that I got a chance to do was speak with a licensed professional counselor about how to handle your health and wellness within this particular time of the pandemic. And one thing that she said that resonated with me was to figure out how to commit yourself to a certain sense of normalcy as much as possible. You know, with whatever that looks like due to the disruption that we're facing as a generation, as our world right now. So I've been looking for ways to find it, you know, still wake up at my 5:30 a.m., you know, try to figure out ways I can work out, stay productive, get my good breakfast in, and just doing little things and scheduling things accordingly.
It's not easy to maintain. But at least the concerted effort is critical.
It is. So not every day is perfect. There's ups and downs, just like everything. But it's just, you know, looking for ways, the best way that you can to kind of manage and navigate through it in the most effective way possible. So
all we can do, I suppose.
Yeah. So where are you coming from today? Where are you at home?
I'm at home. So home for me sort of is all over. I hate to confine myself to one place, but right now I am right deep in the middle, Omaha, Nebraska.
Wow.
Yeah.
So is this home for you in Omaha, Nebraska? Or
sort of. The last 5 years I've been trekking between here and Ann Arbor, Michigan. So that's where I moved from. But I spent substantial amount of my time in Ethiopia and other parts of Africa and Geneva, and sort of my job takes me all over the world. So this is where family is right now.
Nice. Well, I'm glad that you're with family, you know.
So I can't imagine being stuck, because there are a lot of people who are stuck in all sorts of places, right? As it sort of unraveled, I think the enormity of the pandemic unfolded at a pace that we did not expect. And like the sudden closures of airports and travel bans that have caused a lot of people to be stranded in various parts of the world
It's very interesting to be able to think about what we're going through, especially, you know, within the pandemic. I think the best way that I've heard it described was we're all going through a storm, but we're all in different boats.
Mm.
You know, so it's like the pandemic is affecting many different people across the globe. At the same time, there's many people that may be at a place of discomfort, but then there's other people that are in places of things that could be detrimental to livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
And not everyone is affected the same, but we're all being affected, if that makes sense.
No, it absolutely does. I mean, I think if I can think of a time, at least in my adult life, I mean, probably this is the first time that I remember that the entire world is focused on a single issue. Like, usually you may have the Olympics or wars, whether it's Syria or Iraq. So it may be a portion of the world that is hyper focused on that issue. But I think this is the first time that I s remember in my adult life where the entire world is focused on a single issue. So it just shows you the enormity. And you're absolutely right. I mean, we all are impacted differently. The person who has, lost a family or a friend or a person who's lost a livelihood is going to be impacted very differently than somebody who has the luxury and is complaining about being locked down at home, right? So
Right.
certainly the impact is very different.
Yes. So I'm really excited about this conversation and to talk to you online for the first time, just in general, and getting to know a little bit more about you, your story, your work, and all the things that are happening within our Habesha community for Ethiopians, Eritreans globally. So I'm looking forward to this conversation. But just to kind of give everyone that's tuning in right now, welcome to the COVID conversation. Here on Habesha Networks. My name is Nathan Araya, and I am hosting alongside Habesha Networks this conversation with Dr. Sanai Fasaha, who's an incredible leader, lawyer, doctor, advocator, also an advisor for the World Health Organization. And I'll kind of talk a little bit about your bio as well, Dr. Sanai. So, Dr. Sanai Fasaha is a reproductive endocrinology and infertility academic at the University of Michigan. And Director of International Programs at the Susan Buffett Foundation. Fasaha has a law degree and is known for her work as an advocate for global reproductive health rights and gender equality. She is the founder of the Center of International Reproductive Health Training at the University of Michigan. She chaired the election campaign of Tedros Adhanom, the first African Director General of the World Health Organization in 2016 to 2017. So please help me give a big warm welcome for Dr. Sanai Fasaha. So thank you so much for being on this program.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So let's jump right into things. Now, before we even start and asking specific questions on COVID-19, I wanted to know a little bit about how you're handling this personally. Because sometimes we just don't give it's hard for us to kind of humanize people that are on the front lines doing great things, but how are you handling it on a personal level right now?
Well, I'm managing. I think it's we are in an enormously unprecedented and difficult time. And frankly, there's no formula, right? We have to sort of figure it out. So for me, the biggest challenge is how can I not be discouraged, right? Like when you're sitting here and hearing we have very little control over what's happening. Every day you turn your TV on, you'll hear how there is no testing and about 10 million Africans will die and there's no way out of this and the number of unemployment is going, higher every day. So the overwhelming amount of information that you hear just makes you like feel despair and a sense of hopelessness. So my life, not just through this pandemic, but every day is sort of to get up and say, I'm in this world transiently, and how do I use every day using the tools I have? And each of us have different skill sets and different resources and different talents, but how do I use that to not just survive and thrive for myself, but to uplift my community. So this has been enormously helpful through this pandemic, just for me to get up every day and say, how do I take care of myself? How do I take care of my family? I have, four children, ranging from 10 to 18, and a husband and two dogs. And, so how do I get up and take care of them and make sure they still feel safe and secure and have the tools to manage? But how do I think about our communities in Africa? How do I help? How do I collaborate, whoever it is, through academia, through my social networks? Because it's very easy to think there isn't a whole lot you can do. And frankly, you don't have to be a doctor or a lawyer. Each and every one of us can do so much to uplift each other and uplift our communities. So like every day, I do my serenity prayer. I get up and say, God, grant me the serenity, to accept the things, to I cannot change, to change the things I need, and the wisdom to know the difference. So that is sort of my daily routine.
Now, that's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. One thing that I wanted to ask, there was a tweet that I was looking at that really struck me and something that you kind of pinned, and I wanted to read it and kind of get some insight from you. It said, "Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now. Love mercy now. Walk humbly now. You are not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it. How has this quote impacted you and influenced the work in general?
Thank you for sharing that. When I read that poem, those two last lines just stuck with me, right? I mean, it's just the idea that you're not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon. And in this unprecedented time, I think the idea and the remembering every day that we're all in this together, and that it's an enormously, we all have a role to play. What's unfolding in front of us, this journey of humanity, what we do every day, as well as like complicated by this pandemic, right now is very messy and it's overwhelming. But I think it's that gentle reminder of the opportunities that emerge out of this. And for us, how do we take this and walk with integrity and with respect and with love and uplifting each other and uplifting our communities, and not, as I said, like kind of sort of feeling overwhelmed, but allowing an opportunity for our true self to shine. And that is not easy to do, right? So I always remind myself, I don't have to do everything. I just have to do what I can do and do it very well and do it with integrity and respect and without compromising myself. So that sort of has become, I mean, it's not for everyone. Some people think stuff like this is cheesy, but I, especially when it comes from ancient things like, the Jewish laws or the Bible or traditional oral folks like we do in our country, I really find a lot of wisdom in those sayings, and it sort of helps anchor me. But it's been very powerful for me, and that's why I have pinned it on my thread.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I mean, yeah, I was really inspired by that quote, and yeah, it just brings clarity to the work and the things that we do. So yeah, thank you for sharing something so
And I
uplifting.
think if I can add a little bit more, it's also about like living in the present, right? Because it's so easy to sort of think about the past or the future and miss that opportunity about the now. So when I talk about when I interpret that poem in my head, it's sort of like, what needs to be done now? What good can I do for this world? And no matter what, the future is going to unfold in front of us, and we'll worry about that tomorrow.
Yeah,
It's
I
about
love that.
the,
Yeah, I love that. Thank you for sharing. One thing that I was looking at right now, as we're in a pandemic and there's a lot of people that are very disheartened, discomforted, and going through so much all around the world. Now, when we look at specifically related to our culture and customs as a Habesha community, what do you see that we need to change or best adapt in regards to best practices that we should be doing at this moment in time?
So Habeshas have an incredibly powerful and amazing culture. When you look at, through, our communities in the diaspora as well as back home, from coffee ceremony to Sunday church, there's this incredible tradition and sense of solidarity and community, which is amazing. But I think at times like this, there are certain threats as a community that I worry about. One of them is we are not, I think we are as a community, especially you see the intergenerational gap. I mean, a lot of us did not grow up freely sharing information. Part of it is like the baggage we carry of many, many, many years of various kinds of governments and the ability to share information freely. We tend to be very suspicious. And we're not very careful when we pass information from one another. So I see a lot of misinformation, especially around COVID. We are also not very good, especially talking about what is hard, right? Because we are so introspective as a culture. We keep things to ourselves. We don't openly share. I think our culture is extremely secretive. Things like, just even from the highest level of government, information doesn't flow easily. And I think you can see that trickling down. And my hope is like a generation like you guys and my children will have a different reality than your parents, in a sense that you would find courage to come forth with challenges. So I really do worry about struggling families that are not going to come forth. We worry about stigma. We worry about whether it's mental health, poverty, whatever it is that's going to push us over the edge. We're not very good about speaking because we have this pride that keeps us at bay. We don't think about the challenges our kids are going through. We always have the perfect kids who do really well at school, who are getting the best jobs, and our families are doing so well. So that sort of pressure, like keeping up with the Joneses, can really be difficult in times like this if we collectively don't form a way to say, we're there for each other. We're gonna have difficult times. Some of us will be, losing our jobs. We'll have family members who will be sick. Some of us will have difficulty putting food at the table. So how do we create a forum where people have safe spaces to talk about this and pull as a community to support each other? I think we're really good at festive occasions. We're really good showing up when somebody dies, but in the middle, we have a lot of work to do. And I think this is a real opportunity for us to say, how do we start those dialogues? How do we start those intergenerational dialogues between kids and parents and friends and neighbors to say, we're all in this together? And it's not only the weddings and deaths that should bring us together, but we should create a space to talk about difficulties and challenges and being less than perfect.
I agree. I agree so much with that and resonate with that a lot. I think many times as a community, we choose to suppress the things that need to be addressed. And we don't do a good job at really facing the uncertainty and the things that we are uncomfortable with. And due to that, it really does grow a toll within each of us. And it eats us through life when we never really have the opportunity to really to take care of it head on. And I love that we're doing a conversation like this with Habesha Networks tonight, because I think this is a step forward for us to really open up and utilize vulnerability and kind of share a lot of the things and that could destigmatize a lot of these tough issues that we're all trying to deal with as a community together. So I appreciate those words. Now I'm in Texas, and sometimes it's very overwhelming to figure out what information to believe of how COVID-19 is affecting our global community. There's so many news outlets and information that we are currently processing on social media, and sometimes it's very difficult to find how is this really affecting our Habesha community around the world, specifically in Ethiopia and Eritrea. And I know that your work pertains to specifics within those regions and areas. So what, how exactly is COVID-19 really affecting our community around the world, specifically in Eritrea and Ethiopia?
Yeah, no, I think that is a very important question. So, and I'm glad you sort of categorized it, right? Like, so there is those of us of Ethiopian and Eritrean origin that are in the West that have relatively better access to information. So whether it is going to the World Health Organization, which is the sole authority in developing guidelines and, how do you cope? Hand washing, keeping a certain social distance, wearing masks, whatever it is, and sort of what can you do to protect yourself and your family, or the Center for Disease Control, right? So those are the two most credible sources. And then when you look at Ethiopia and Eritrea, where do we look? Of course, they get their guidelines from the WHO, but the local Ministry of Health, the regional health bureaus, they seem to be the most credible source. So there is information, there is misinformation. I worry the most about, not so much about the accurate information. I think the governments and social civil society and individuals, I mean, I have been blown away by how many young people have stepped up to fill the void. When I see the number of young people, including, Mike Ndala, who really put together an incredible group of COVID task force of, diaspora techies from all over, reached out to me on Twitter and said, we want support. Where do we get started? Right here, like go to the Ministry of Health. So they are unbelievable source of accurate information. But those are sort of preserved for those that are in the cities, those that have access to the internet. So the really challenge is, how do we get accurate information to people who live in rural areas, people who don't have accesses, people who are away from far cities? So unfortunately, for a country like Ethiopia and Eritrea, we usually rely on government to getting accurate information. But the amount of misinformation that is going out there through Facebook, and for our people, if something is on Facebook or it's on the internet, it becomes absolutely true, right? So really being careful as critical as we should be about getting accurate information, we have to be really, really critical about inaccurate information. COVID, particularly in the continent of Africa, has also challenged and blurred the line between religion, faith, and science. While we all should, absolutely in tough and in good and bad times, look into our spirituality and faith, when you have faith leaders and when we have people in the name of religion start, stepping up and using this as an opportunity to say, God is punishing you, that's why you're getting this. Imagine, these are people who have the moral authority to get accurate information. And we are seeing over and over again religion being used as a tool to create fear and to create anxiety, to create, I mean, the president of Tanzania, for example, declared that God is going to be the answer and we're going to not close churches. And in fact, I'm going to order 3 days of prayer, right? Like he went to populism, he went to church and he said, I won't close a house of God. So when you take such irresponsible measures, when government fails to respect its social contract with its people, that's when we really get in trouble, right? Because what we know is this pandemic, COVID-19, is the one disease that we can protect ourselves by doing nothing. Basically, to the extent we can, staying away from mass gatherings, creating physical distance, physical distance, not emotional distancing, not remaining connected, but keeping at least 6 feet distance from the next person, washing our hands. So those information can be found either with the local authorities, but I absolutely have been overwhelmed by the amount of misinformation from you can chew garlic, from you can wash this off, or all sorts of misinformation. And I think we have the social responsibility to ensure that we combat this misinformation, because especially those that are much less fortunate than us, who look at it as a source of information, if we say to them we read this on the internet and they follow up, we know that we're not affecting just ourselves and immediate, family, but entire communities.
It's a lot.
Been fascinating to see, as you know, right now over 4 million people are affected, with 300,000 deaths, almost a quarter, like one third of that is in the US. So when you look at Eritrea and Ethiopia, because African leaders showed unusual and unprecedented leadership in shutting down their airports and closing their borders and, banning mass gatherings. Eritrea so far has reported only 39 cases with zero death, and Ethiopia has now reached about 275 cases with about five deaths. Having said that, there are significant limitations around testing. We don't have enough test kits. We need do a lot more aggressive testing. A lot fortunate for us, a lot of the cases are imported. So as long as we quarantine people coming through, we make sure we test them, isolate those that are infected, contact trace people who've come in contact with them and quarantine those, we can manage this pandemic. But this has to be coupled with very, very aggressive testing. And due to material shortage and other things, we have not been as good with the testing.
So, right now, I think within the US, at least for me personally, I've been in quarantine for about a little over 2 months now. And, it just seems that information is always coming out, 3 more months, or it's gonna affect us for 2 more years. And, so there's just a lot of information out. When do you see us getting back to a sense of normalcy? And how does this timeline impact our families and communities back home?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, each community sort of has to figure out what works for it. I think the reality for our communities back home is going to be very different from the reality in the West. The simple answer is none of us know. When, first of all, I think we're going to emerge with a whole new set of normalcies than what we're used to, right? So I myself spent 70 to 80% of my time on airplanes, right? I work in 75 countries. I'm always jet setting, to Asia or Africa or somewhere. And just the amount of work that I have been able to do through remote, teleworking and Zoom conferencing is gonna, we as a, as I think as a country and as humanity are gonna emerge out of this, hopefully being a lot more mindful about our carbon footprint and what can we do and how can we be effective and efficient and communicate. So whatever normal we will have when we emerge out of this, I am sure is going to look very different than what we're used to. Having said that, I don't think we have any idea what when that will happen. The idea is we'll have a vaccine, and the only way for sure to protect ourselves would be if we can produce an effective vaccine at a high quantity enough to cover everybody who needs it, right? The challenge with vaccines are somebody has to pay for the research and development. And usually those who fork the resources are the ones that also get access to it. So right now, the World Health Organization is really focused to say, listen, none of us are safe until we all are safe. So how do we develop a vaccine that will be equitably distributed to everyone around the world? Frankly, right now, the prediction is that even if it's all accelerated and some phased human trials are starting, we anticipate it will take 12 to 18 months. As you know already in California and so many other schools, fall classrooms are being suspended. So at least we know through the end of the year, most kids will be taking school online or some sort of modified classrooms. But for the rest of the world, this is not a reality. If you look at Ethiopia or Eritrea, where the majority of people earn their livelihood by going out and selling food on the streets, this option of locking yourself down is not a reality. They also live small homes, you know, where intergenerational families live, or a very small space. So the pandemic prevention steps that are implemented in this country are not realistic. So many people are now going back to work. Data is emerging from Asia, South Korea, and other countries. I mean, based on the WHO guideline, I was one of the first to say we don't need to wear masks, save them only for healthcare providers who get this virus exposure repetitively, but now we have evidence that wearing masks can protect because we know that there are people who are sick but could transmit the virus. So the reality is, I don't think Africa can lock itself down for long. A lot of people need to go out and earn their living. And frankly, if they don't die from the pandemic, we will die from poverty and from malnutrition and from other things. We also don't have bailouts. We don't have a government that writes fat checks. So the government has to figure out, and frankly, it is a combination of very aggressive testing strategy to contain the virus and avoiding mass gatherings and what have you, but also looking at the poorest of the poor and saying, how can we support these communities? And I think that's where, in addition to government, where we have seen the generosity of our communities is that many people are stepping up, putting, you know, writing their checks, putting their money to send money to Ethiopia and to Eritrea and to families and ensuring that they have the basic necessities that we take for granted. But yeah, it's going to be a long time before we know what normal is, and that new normal is going to be very different from what we have known in the past.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, in the meantime, what can we do to eat better, drink better, build up our immune system to kind of help prevent or protect ourselves from the coronavirus? Because that's a huge thing that we can at least have some sort of control over.
No, absolutely. I think that sense of hopelessness is dangerous. I think there is a lot we can do. First of all, there are like basic public health measures like washing your hands vigorously and very frequently with soap and water. If you can't, don't have access to water, using alcohol-based wipes, at least 70% alcohol, not touching your face with eyes and nose with your hands. Keeping social distance. If you develop a symptom, calling your healthcare provider, especially if you develop fever and cough and what have you. But we also know that a lot of people don't develop fevers or maybe asymptomatic and carrying the virus. So I think the public health measures are very important. Having said that, taking care of ourselves is so important, both our physical and mental health. And, you know, getting adequate sleep, hydrating, building a routine for some physical exercise, because when your body's stressed, both physical and mental and emotional stress, you're more prone to, you know, wearing out your immune system and being more prone to infection. So, you know, exercising, green leafy vegetables. I mean, if we stick to an Ethiopian, like his own traditional fasting diet, that's probably the best thing we can do. But lots of vegetables, lots of fruit, hydrating and building routines, going to bed and waking up at a routine time and building exercise. And frankly, for those who eat a balanced diet and eat their fruits and vegetables and protein, some supplemental stuff will not be necessary. But not everyone eats like that. So making sure that you take your supplemental vitamins. We know that a strong immune system is what protects you from fighting, any virus or bacteria. So that is absolutely critical. And the other thing I would stress is being kind to yourself, being kind to others. Just remembering that, there are days I get really upset on something or someone, and then I try to remind myself that, just sort of my previous pinned tweet before this one was, be kind, for everyone is suffering a battle that you don't know about, you may not know about, right? So people have their struggles. Most people that I know get up and just, they don't roll out of bed to just make others miserable, but their life circumstances force them. So understanding and having empathy to ourselves, to our families, to our communities. I particularly worry about young people who, my son who's 18 was a freshman at Berkeley, super excited, had started his own independent life in the dorms away from family. All of a sudden, he's back in the dorms, locked up, back in the house from his dorms and locked up here for months, right? So what does it mean when you are, especially as an Ethiopian, Eritrean community, we really don't look at mental health very well. So what is the impact of the social separation and physical separation of young people from their friends? The inability. So I really encourage my kids. Normally, my mantra used to be keep off your cell phones, keep off your, social network. Now it's like connect, talk to your friends, talk to us. Yes, keep physical distance, but not the actual social connection. So I think there is a lot we can do to help ourselves and our communities.
Right. I love how you said that. I think one of the biggest shifts of thinking for me has been to separate the difference between an inconvenience and a problem. And I think that's been something that's been more empowering for me that, I'm blessed with a place to stay. I'm blessed with, being able to work from home. I'm blessed with certain things. So it's how do we use our privilege, as a responsibility to better the lives of those within our community? And I think being able to see things as an inconvenience for those that have it, instead of as a problem, can really help empower right thinking and right doing. So I think it's been a challenge, as it always is, but I think there's some great education through the process that we can learn to better ourselves and those that are around us. Now, I know we have a lot of questions coming up, but one thing I wanted to ask before we jump into a Q&A is how do we support our fellow Habesha medical workers locally and abroad?
Wow, there's a lot we can do. The first one being emotional support. As you know, both in the US and back home, healthcare providers work under extenuating circumstances. I came here after high school and did all my training here. So although I spent now substantial amount of time both in Ethiopia and in Eritrea building training programs and working with doctors very closely, I've always looked at the US health system being near perfect. Of course, we see inequities in access, but at least the health system itself appeared like it was solid. And this pandemic has shown us the weakness of the health system, particularly the public health system. So both here and abroad, and both here and in back home, providers are really suffering from having basic tools, like basic things like personal protective equipment. They are putting themselves and their families at risk when they show up to work and don't have masks to cover their faces, don't have goggles, they don't have gowns. So the response from the community has been enormous. Stuff that we take for granted, that walking to Rite Aid or Walgreens or CVS and being able to buy a mask or Ace Hardware like my husband did yesterday is not a reality for many of our brothers and sisters and that are frontline providers. So how do we mobilize? How do we get resources? I know people in the Washington, D.C. area and throughout the U.S. have been fundraising, getting medical equipment. Frankly, it's more than the medical equipment. The emotional support is enormously important. So if you know someone who's a healthcare provider, especially nurses, ICU workers who are really at the front line and are seeing the hardest, the sickest of the sick, Many of them have quarantined, especially in the West, have quarantined themselves from their families. So whether it is, if you know a nurse or a doctor, dropping by, sending them a card, dropping a meal, not that they need it, but it is absolutely powerful to show that we care about them as a community. And then frankly, if our healthcare workers are not safe, we're not safe. So just showing solidarity, showing support, and never expecting that what one individual can do is a small effort. It's not. Every little effort makes a difference. And especially for those of us on this side of the bridge, the side of the ocean, there's so much we can do in mobilizing resources and mobilizing supplies, in working as a community to cheer for them. But more than the material, or as important as the material, is the emotional support. So I will say giving them shout outs, celebrating the work they're doing, reaching out, listening to their pleas, working with those that are in power, so that their needs are met. Right now, the biggest challenge they have, and you have seen it both in the US and back home, is that healthcare providers not being able to test themselves when they think they're exposed to the virus, or not being able to protect themselves, is the biggest risk. And when that happens, it's not only them, it's also their families, because they go back and take care of their families. One other point, particularly for back home, it's also true here to an extent, is that 70% of frontline healthcare providers are women. So if you look at in the context of Eritrea and Ethiopia, the community health workers are mostly women, nurses are mostly women. So these are the ones who are facing, they are paid low, they are frontline, they are putting themselves at risk. And then when they go back, there's still enormous pressure to take care of their families, putting their families in harm's way. And you don't find them oftentimes sitting at the decision, making tables. So their interests are not represented. So I think as a community, we can also use our voice to speak on their behalf, to advocate for them, to ensure that the governments and those in power and development partners keep their interests at the forefront. So I think there is a lot we can do.
Yeah, thank you so much for shedding light on ways that we can support medical workers locally and abroad. I think that brings a lot of opportunities and ideas that we can all kind of gather around and implement. So, yeah, thank you for that. We have about 19 minutes, and I want to be mindful of your time and all of our audience around the world that is tuning in with a couple of questions that we have. So, the first question that I wanted us to ask, many Habeshaos work in the service industry and small business owners. How do you recommend we move forward and stay safe?
So I think that is the biggest challenge we're facing right now, is how do we balance public health measures with maintaining the economic needs of families, right? So especially for those who are small businesses that are in the front line, who cannot just keep away, or keeping in shelter or in lockdown comes at a cost to their families and to their businesses. So striking that balance and following the guidelines the state government, federal governments are putting out for those who live in this country, and for those back home, what the government is putting out, what does safety look like? What are the kind of trends we want to follow? So for example, if you've seen what's happening in New York, a few weeks ago, it was the hot spot where the highest number of deaths, the highest number of, because when you start looking at hospitalization and deaths, that is sort of a reflection of what's happening in the community. So when hospital admissions start dropping, when deaths start dropping and new infections start reducing, you know that the virus is sort of kind of slowing down. But what that means is not that we can go out, because what would happen is if people go out, because we have to do businesses and we have to earn a living, what would happen is the virus, if we don't aggressively test and figure out, in the ideal world, some of the estimation in the US, for example, is we need to do 5 million tests a day to be able to safely open up our economy. And we're not there at all. Right now, the kind of testing we have is PCR based, it's cumbersome, you need like nose swabs or throat swabs, you need a healthcare provider, it has to be sent to a laboratory and you have to wait for it. So really, we are accelerating. The government and private sector is investing very heavily for rapid diagnostic tests. But once they are available and also equitably accessible to everyone, that is when we can fully open up, because we can separate who's infected and who's not, if we also need to couple that with contact tracing, none of those things are in place. So right now, as it is, it's going to be very, very tough to go out and set yourself up, because what we expect would happen is we'll get a second wave of infection. Right now, seems like things are stalling, but if we rapidly go out and do what we used to do without all these other measures in place, we're going to see another wave and we'll be forced to lock down. So how do we balance that economic need that is real, right? Because you have to pay rent, you have to pay mortgage, you have to pay your employees. And how do you balance that with the need to stay healthy and safe?
Right. I know me as well as so many people have plans to travel back home, whether it be Ethiopia or Eritrea this year. And due to the pandemic, we are unable to do so. So one question that did come up was, how do we go back and stay safe? What does going back home look like in the future?
Well, I wish I knew. I don't know. I don't think many of us know. And frankly, I mean, I can attempt to answer it, but it's going to be anyone can speculate like I have. We have felt better that if people can social distance, if planes left their aisle in the middle, if we constantly wipe the surfaces, because the initial thought on COVID was that it was not transmitted through the air. And only if somebody who was sick coughed on you and or you came in physical contact, that's why we thought if we wiped, if we do this, if we do that. But the evidence seemed to suggest otherwise. In fact, for those of you who have not read it, there was a story in New York Times today about an NBC reporter who did all the precautions that we talked about, who wore masks, gloves, surface wiped everything on the plane, but his job required him, and he's now in the ICU. And so, really, it's going to be hard to know when it would be fully safe for all of us to travel. I mean, flights are still operating from Washington, Ethiopia, and Eritrea. I'm not sure. I think Eritrea had closed its borders. I don't know if it's open back again, but at least I know to Addis it's open. When you arrive, you will be quarantined for 14 days, which I think is absolutely critical because most of the cases in Africa are mostly imported from Europe, and to some extent to China and various routes through Dubai and other places. So you will be quarantined for 14 days. If you have any symptom, you will be tested, and only when you're free, you're allowed back to the community. And I think that's an extremely important measure. So if one has a burning desire to go back home, those are the measures. But I think you will put yourself in significant risk being stranded in a plane for 12, 13 hours. The assumption we had was the air filter was very significant and the likelihood of getting infected in the plane is very low, but that is being questioned right now.
Thank you
So
for that. Thank
I
you for that.
minimize travel at least until we get some level of normalcy.
Right. Thank you for that. How confident are you that we can create an effective and safe vaccine? And will it be affordable? That was one of our questions that just came up.
Yeah, I know. That's, I think, in terms of the ability to create the vaccine, I feel pretty confident because we've done this over and over again, from H1N1 to SARS, and measles and smallpox and all sorts of viruses and bacteria that we're developing, especially the viruses that we're developing vaccines for. The issue is just because we develop effective vaccines, it doesn't mean that we'll use it effectively. And we know that now, right? I mean, polio is almost eradicated, but it's not eradicated. Measles, we see measles outbreaks, especially with misinformation and this anti-vaxxer movement. We're seeing significant setbacks. So just because we have an effective vaccine, it doesn't mean that communities and governments will use it effectively. That's one. And the second point that was raised is absolutely critical about equitable use and access to vaccine. What we know, for example, from 2003, SARS outbreak, and then, H1N1, is that when vaccines are developed, they will develop 3 billion for the developing world and 100 million for everybody else, right? So with, what makes this pandemic very unique is that I think with the virus being present in 188 countries and 4 million people already impacted, US cannot be safe until everyone in Africa is safe. So frankly, there is now self-interest that will drive the accessibility of the virus because you are not going to shut your doors forever, right? So historically, if it's going to be a disease, it won't come to me. It's Ebola, it's going to stay in Africa. You tend to be less eager to share your resources. But what's unique about this virus is that it is not very safe or effective to vaccinate only those that have resources. So the WHO has led a big initiative where world leaders, and in fact, the European Union Commission raised 3 billion euros in one day for that is going towards vaccines and therapeutics and diagnostics. It's called ACT, accelerating the COVID tools that we need both to diagnose, treat, including vaccine. So we're very optimistic that we will develop this vaccine. It is a matter of time, and we absolutely need to be intentional, especially those that are the most vulnerable who will have access to it. As we know, the people that are getting the sickest and that have the highest risk of death are people that are old, over 60, and people that are have comorbidities, other, infections like HIV, diabetes, and kidney disease. It doesn't mean that we don't see healthy people die. Of course, we're seeing that as well, but the numbers are much fewer. So it does not make sense to make a vaccine that is not going to be available to everyone. Right now, the world seems to be committed to doing that.
Right. And there's also conversations right now that's just coming up. I thought it was interesting in regards to climate, and I'm seeing a few back and forth conversations. So does climate affect the virus like we've heard? And I think someone was mentioning, is that why Africa has low cases?
So no one can say for certain, but of course we've heard a lot of things why Africa does not have the virus. The first misinformation that was going around was black people don't get the virus. Well, we now have over 60,000 cases in Africa, and we know that we can get it. There was also a lot of question around climate. Had countries that had warm temperature in January, Vietnam and several others were getting COVID. So temperature alone. So of course, what happens is during the cold weather, people tend to aggregate together in closed spaces. So that may accelerate the chance. But right now, we don't have clear evidence that this follows any weather pattern because we're seeing it in cold and hot climates equally. There is also speculation around altitude and is the reason why, because for example, people who live in high altitude like Ethiopia, we know from our athletes have high oxygen carrying capacity in their lungs. So there is some theory now that could that be the case? The truth is, from the time the first case is reported to getting large number of cases takes several months. We've seen this in many, many countries. In the US, the first case was reported in January, and we didn't see a rise. In fact, significant pattern started emerging about this being a full-blown pandemic in this country almost at the end of March. So there was over a 2.5 month lapse when this happened. So I think we're still early in Africa. We're beginning to see cases significantly. African leaders, like I said, also have taken unprecedented measures, shutting their borders. But frankly, there is also a limitation about testing. So when we see high cases in South Africa and in Egypt, it's because these countries have much better access for and testing capacity than the rest of us. I mean, a country like Ethiopia that has a population of 110 million should be doing minimum 100,000 tests a day. And right now, I think our peak right now is about 5,000. The same with there. The population of 5 million, we should be seeing significant more testing. But as testing improves and if they continue to truly, especially shut borders, quarantine, especially when you open up flight, quarantine people who come in because a lot of them are being imported and contact trace those people and isolate the people who are infected, I think we can get a handle around it. But I think the best way to manage this pandemic is by having testing available. And I don't want anyone to get this false illusion that Africa is going to remain like this. The cases are rising. They're rising significantly. We've seen a doubling within a week. We're working very closely with Africa CDC on a continental response strategy. And we all are pushing for very, very, very aggressive testing of people that are suspecting the virus.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I want to get to one question in about 7 minutes. Once again, looking to honor your time. One question that did come up was, is there truth to the theory washing your hands excessively and social distancing will actually weaken our immune system since we are not strengthening our immune system?
So I'm gonna put my doctor hat and say no. You can never wash your hands too much. You can get dry hands, right? I mean, so you the things just from excessive soap and washing, you can get dry hands. You can see this on people who wash dishes all the time. But you can never wear your immune system out by washing your hands too much. So please wash your hands as many times as you can. For those of you who have access to water, we have to remember, 40% of our population doesn't have access to even drinking, like clean drinking water. So hand washing is elusive for many, many people. But for those of us who have access, please continue to wash your hands every day, frequently, every time you can. In terms of social distancing, there is theory, not necessarily just keeping 6 feet away, but there seem to be some data that suggests people who are in very sterile environments may not build their immunity. So for example, you see one of the theories why we see a very high level of nut allergy in this country that we don't see in Ethiopia, for example. I mean, part of it is it may be there, we may just not know it because we're accepting and we're used to kids dying of all sorts of things. But at least you don't see like kids who move from Africa to here developing peanut allergy, whereas many kids that are born here tend to be sensitive. It's because we had made sure their diet is devoid of certain things. So the same way, when you live in a very sterile environment and you're not going out, you always run the risk saying if your body does not see this bacteria and viruses, are you not going to be able to develop the immunity? So I think it's a good question to ask, but keeping few 6 feet away from another individual is not going to compromise your immunity as well. And in fact, right now, that's the only thing we know that is slowing the spread of the virus. So I will say, wash your hands. Please keep physical distancing, not social distancing, and avoid touching your eyes and nose with your hands.
Right. Thank you so much for shedding light on that. What I also want to take some time towards the end of this conversation to highlight some organizations that I would like everyone that's attending from home to look more into. Again, these are organizations that serve many different capacities, so do your due diligence with educating yourself and figuring out what would be the most fit for you to be able to make the impact that you want to have. So the first organization I wanted to bring to the table today was the Ethio COVID Task Force Team, which is a global volunteer team of doctors, engineers, designers, product managers, and more building open source projects with the Ministry of Health to help contain and prevent COVID-19. So fundraiser begins next week. So if you have any questions, definitely research that. I think they have an Instagram account. It's the Ethiopian COVID Task Force Team. So look more into that. If you have any questions, contact Habesha Networks or myself, and we'll definitely be able to point you in the right direction. The second thing, Eritrea fights COVID-19. They are helping Eritrea's Ministry of Health treat and prevent the spread of the pandemic in Eritrea. That's www.eritreafightscovid19.org. So that is another organization that you can do your due diligence in educating yourself about and learning more about their work to see if it best fits you for the type of impact you want to make. And then there is the Distant Relatives Project, which is a nonprofit committed to the development of underserved communities around the world by creating opportunity and access to resources. The DRP is launching a new campaign to supply personal protective equipment to our healthcare professionals at Black Lion Hospital in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. The three donation points are the GoFundMe. They have a GoFundMe.com/ PPE for healthcare professionals in Ethiopia. And then they have a Cash App that is the $ distant relatives. And then the third way to give is through the website, and that's distant-relatives.org/give. So if you have any questions in regards to any of those organizations, feel free to reach out to Habesha Networks or myself, and we can point you in the right direction to educate and learn about ways that you can give if it best fits you. So those are some of the organizations. Once again, Dr. Sanai, we just thank you so much for giving us your time, your insight, and your hard-earned experience with what you've been kind of seeing on the ground. And we do appreciate all the work. We hope that you continue to fight the good fight and continue doing the great work We have about less than 2 minutes left. Do you have any final words or ways that people can get in contact with you beyond this Instagram live conversation?
Absolutely. I just want to say how proud I am of you, Habesha Network, the entire Ethiopian Eritrean community, especially young people. I am just literally every day get up and say, oh, like this is, you know, what more can you ask for? The number of young people who reach out to me who are just really trying to give back. And for me, I just get moved when I see first generation Ethiopians and Eritreans who are born and raised in this country, but have that cultural identity and see the need to give back, the need to have that deep connection with who they are, with their roots. So I will say, keep up the good fight, keep up the good work. If you really need to reach out to me for anything, it's my handle is at Dr. Sanait in Instagram, DM me on Twitter. You know, anything that I can be of any help to the community. I really fundamentally and deeply believe that the only way we can all collectively grow is if we uplift each other. And it's so important for young people to have mentors who ensure that the mentors, you know, hindsight becomes the young person's foresight. So I would put myself out there if you need anything. Thank you so much for having me and keep the conversation going because this our community needs this open dialogue more than any time now. So thank you, Nate, and great for thank you for your moderation.
Anytime. Thank you again. All right. Well, everyone, have an amazing night. Feel free to reach out to Dr. Sunlight, Habesha Networks, or myself if you have any further questions. And we will keep the conversation going. And we'll see y'all soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey guys, thank you for listening. The show is powered by Ground Zero Coffee, an East African coffee company focused on community impact through storytelling and social enterprise. Ground Zero serves specialty grade and ethically traded coffee sourced from its place of origin, Ethiopia, and the greater East African regions. Ground Zero is committed to creating new narratives and closing the wealth gap within underrepresented communities worldwide through storytelling and social enterprise. Be sure to show your support and order your coffee from Ground Zero now at startfromgroundzero.com.